Welcome to episode 391. Fertility, menopause, and cancer risk. What do they all have in common? Hormones. If you're in a place where you're unsure about whether or not HRT or bioidentical hormones are or are not a good idea to help you eliminate your awful menopause symptoms, increase or decrease your cancer risk, or simply whether or not they can enhance the quality of your life, then this podcast is for you because we're talking about the why and the how about using functional medical testing to find out the answers to all of these questions and concerns that you might have around hormone replacement therapy. And if you want to know more about that, then let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? How are you? Well, I hope. Obviously, your day is heading in a good direction if this podcast has showed up on your to-do list. Now, in 2024, it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. And the links to inquire about our programs or to book a discovery call with me or one of my team members, that link is in the show notes down below. Okay, so today's guest is a naturopathic doctor who graduated from the National University of Natural Medicine in the USA. She has an undergraduate degree in biochemistry and cell biology, and similar to me, is a bit of a nerd, and throughout her career has specialized in IBS and women's hormones for fertility, menopause, and HRT use. Currently, she is a clinical educator for Precision Analytical, the company that make and create and distribute the Dutch hormone test. And the woman with all of these skills and accolades is Dr. Kelly Roof. Kel, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Maddie. I'm happy to be here.
I'm excited that you're here. We actually chatted almost a year ago on a Zoom call, and since then you've had a baby, so congratulations.
Thank you. Has it been a year already?
Yeah, looking at our notes. October. We were last on a Zoom.
Yep. Had my baby in January.
And everything went smoothly.
It did. Oh my gosh, so smoothly. Very, very, very thankful for that. Yeah, my first was a little different story. So very happy it went smooth.
Actually, I've got a question that's just sort of popped up. With all of your own sort of natural health education, medical education, and specifically hormone and fertility research and knowledge, how was your own pregnancy or pregnancies, how were they different or more challenging than you expected them to be based on your sort of textbook knowledge?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I think there were probably some symptoms I didn't expect. I kind of assumed I would be nauseous in the first trimester because I just tend to trend towards nausea. Just in my 20s, I was nauseous a lot. So I was like, I'm for sure going to be nauseous when I'm pregnant. But it was cool to really know what I know about naturopathic medicine because I was able to take the right supplements, make sure I was exercising. My first pregnancy, I cut out sugar. You know, for example, we know that there's research on a certain probiotic that contains, what is it, Reuteri and Lactobacillus, I think. And if you take that probiotic, it could lower your chances for being positive for group B strep when they swab you around 36, 37 weeks. Because if you're positive for group B strep, you have to do IV antibiotics during delivery.
Oh, interesting.
And so with my first, you know, I was very like gung-ho, did all the supplements, like did all the dietary things, exercised, didn't have group B strep, you know, it was great. My second, I was a little more lenient. I didn't really take as many supplements. I still exercised. I didn't cut out all sugar though. It was kind of like, you know, like I've done this before, it's going to be okay. But I had group B strep. And I really regret not taking those probiotics because I had to take, well, I chose to take the IV antibiotics during delivery. But yeah, I don't know. It's every pregnancy is different. That's the interesting thing. Like even when you learn about it, you never know what you're going to get.
For sure. I'm curious with your knowledge and your own experience there, is that something that fermented food can do or is fermented food not powerful enough? Like if that was, say, fermented food was maintained throughout that journey?
I don't know. I don't know if there's any research on that in group B strep, but we know that fermented food can definitely improve the microbiome, keep it healthy. And I do think that just to some degree, if we're not taking care of ourselves and if we're stressed out and eating a poor diet and et cetera, it could make us more prone to having group B strep. But there's a certain percentage of the population of women that are colonized with group B strep. So there's a certain population that's always going to show up positive. But I do wonder if we all adopted healthier lifestyles and ate more fermented foods, if we, I mean, I think we'd lower that percentage quite a bit.
Yeah. It's, it seems to logically, without a study, it seems to logically make sense that that would, A, would lead to less B in this scenario.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so you're a clinical educator, primarily on all things Dutch and hormone related. And for many people listening, they're probably like, what is the Dutch test? What is Dutch? You know, are we going traveling? What is going on? So maybe we can start with simply, what is the Dutch test and why is it important?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Dutch is an acronym and it stands for dried urine testing for comprehensive hormones. And we're mostly testing urine, though we do test a little bit of saliva, but basically we're looking at hormones and their metabolites in the urine. And we also look at cortisol, you know, what cortisol is doing throughout the day. See that diurnal pattern in the urine or the saliva. And we look at organic acids, which can tell us a little bit about nutrient status, dysbiosis, inflammation in the body, DNA damage in the body, even if we're deficient in glutathione or not. So the Dutch test, it's really a very, it's comprehensive. We can get a lot of data from it. It's not diagnostic, but we can understand a little bit more about what our hormones are doing in our body and how they might be contributing to our fatigue or our inability to maintain muscle mass or to exercise, or heavy bleeding, or irregular menstrual cycles, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on.
Yeah. So anything hormone related. And is it only women?
No. I mean, I'd say mainly the majority of the people who are doing the test are women, but we do have a lot of men testing with us also.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good to know. Yeah. And I think as well in this world where, you know, HRT and bioidentical hormones are a huge part of the conversation, and we've got men with plummeting testosterone levels basically everywhere. And yeah, that's sort of severe experience that people going through menopause experience, as well as the hikes in endometriosis, you know, the Dutch test and that information is becoming, you know, increasingly more important.
Yeah, especially because in the urine on the Dutch test, we're able to look at downstream hormone metabolites and that you cannot test in the serum. And the downstream metabolites can give us a little more information about, like, you know, why a woman might be suffering with endometriosis or why her periods are heavy or why she has acne, even though her testosterone is normal in the serum.
Yeah, that's interesting. With people that would get the Dutch test, is that something that you would get from a medical doctor or do you need to, is that more of a natural health thing? Or do you need your natural health practitioner to write a letter to your doctor?
Yeah, well, anyone who has testing rights, like anyone who is able to order testing and order it from Dutch. So I don't know about it outside the US, but I do know in the US we have registered dietitians and nurse practitioners and DOs and MDs and chiropractors. And there's a lot of different people who can order the Dutch test. And so you would go to one of those providers, or you can order them online yourself. Patients can order it too.
Yeah, it's the same here actually. Yeah, in the sense that, yeah, a lot of different types of practitioners can order them. And yeah, they're available to be purchased online from here as well. So it's kind of similar. But in your experience, like, and what comes to mind is the, you know, sort of the menopausal group or the sort of women that are in their, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s kind of era of their life where things are going absolutely haywire. It feels like in my world, at least, because I work primarily with women in that age bracket and also just as a health professional, it feels like menopause is a huge part of the conversation right now. And everybody's got thoughts, but nobody has the answer. So my first question is, with all of your Dutch knowledge, why is menopause so bad for so many women? And is it worse now than it was 100 years ago?
Oh, that's a really good question. I don't know how it was 100 years ago. I wish I had more information on that. I don't know if I've ever really had that thought. That's a really good thought. For a lot of women, most of us, if we can survive to that age, are going to go through menopause, and it's kind of inevitable. And I think if I had to guess, I would think that 100 years ago, not many women were going through menopause, you know, or less. Definitely less women were going through menopause than they are today. And with menopause these days, a lot of women are symptomatic. You know, they have the hot flashes, they've got the night sweats, the insomnia, the mood issues, the vaginal dryness, the joint pain, the wrinkles. You know, there's cardiovascular issues. There's a lot of things that happen during menopause that a lot of women don't even realize happen during menopause. Mm-hmm. A lot of women think of hot flashes, but they don't understand that our risk for cardiovascular events goes up during that time and our melatonin drops. And some women have mood issues so severe they become suicidal. You know, it's not that severe for everyone. I don't want to scare everyone. But I would think that menopausal symptoms might be worse today than 100 years ago. And I'm only saying that because, well, I don't know. They have a lot of stressors back then too. But we're exposed to a lot more toxins and environmental pollutants these days. A lot of us have just chronic stress. When women are in their 40s, 50s, going through menopause, it tends to be an already stressful time in their lives. You know, they're really, you know, knee deep in their careers. They've got aging parents. They've got children that they're taking care of. There's just a lot going on in their lives during that time. So there's a lot of stress. And that stress, of course, is impacting adrenal health. And we always think of the adrenals as secreting cortisol, which is the, you know, the stress hormone. But the adrenals also, for women, make the majority of our androgens. And androgens are, you know, male sex hormones, or we call them male sex hormones. They're like testosterone and DHEA. And so for women, if they've been stressed out their whole lives, or let's say they started like getting stressed out from relationships and jobs and career in their 20s and 30s and 40s, you know, our androgens naturally decline as we get older. But when we're really stressed out, they'll decline even faster.
Yeah.
And so what I see with the Dutch testing is a lot of women in their 40s, 50s, even 30s have lower androgens than we would expect just from chronic stress. And that's difficult. I think that makes menopause more challenging because androgens give us our overall sense of well-being. They help with building muscle mass. They help with insulin sensitivity. They help us be able to exercise and recover from exercise. They support our joints, our libido, our skin, our hair, our nails. And so when they drop off quickly, we become more symptomatic. And I really do think that if we don't take care of our adrenals when we're younger and cycling, when we go through menopause, we can have more symptoms. Because if we have low androgens, our estrogen tends to be low too. And we know there's a lot of symptoms with low estrogen.
As you just said there, you know, if we don't look after ourselves when we're younger, there was an interesting tie between all of the things that get affected, like, you know, skin, nails, hair, libido, muscles. And if I think about that list of things that you just put together, all of those things, even for men, pertain to self-confidence, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how I feel in my body, how my body engages with the world, how I look in the mirror, all of that kind of stuff. And then I think about if we don't, you know, what you said about being younger and looking after yourself and your health and your hormones. And it presents the question for me, and I obviously say this as a man, so sympathy and empathy goes out to women and acknowledging that I can't fully understand maybe even the answer to this question. But what are women doing wrong in their younger years? And the first thing that comes to mind for me is the contraceptive pill. But what can they do in the younger years to you know, maybe, and maybe we've got some 20 people in their 20s or 30s listening to this thinking, oh, I want to, you know, help myself when I'm older. Because I often refer to the pill, like, you know, the contraceptive pill, as stealing years from the future. And so I'm wondering, you know, what can be done to make menopause better a little bit later in life, even though that might, the window or time frame for that happening might be 10 or 20 years away.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many things that women and men can do when they're younger. And the pill, you know, the pill is, it's a hard one. So for some women, it's a lifesaver. And for some women, it's very necessary. But for a lot of women, I personally think there are alternatives to prevent pregnancy. And we know that the pill depletes nutrients and vitamins and minerals. It's associated with gastric issues. And I think it's associated with like increased risk of IBD, inflammatory bowel disease.
Yeah.
And, you know, it increases risk for breast cancer. Also, once you're off of it for 5 years, I think that risk is normalized. But yeah, the pill can definitely be an issue. But in their younger years, a lot of times people will overexercise.
Right.
That's one that comes to mind. And it's interesting because our androgens, like our DHA and testosterone, help us build our muscle mass. They help us exercise. But you'll see this in athletes, like people who are overexercising or doing strenuous exercise on a daily basis. Their androgens drop off more quickly. Because whenever you exercise, you're taxing your adrenals. And if you're overexercising, you're just going to overdo it with the adrenals. And the adrenals, every time you exercise, the adrenals make cortisol to help you exercise. But you're going to kind of wear out that HPA access. You'll get HPA access dysfunction over time. And then your androgens, like your DHA, your testosterone that are made from the adrenals, drop off more quickly than they would for someone who's not over exercising.
Yeah.
And the irony is when you're an athlete, you need androgens. But when you overdo it, your androgens like decline to the point where you start noticing you just can't work out the way you used to. You can't lift the weights like you used to. So I would say that's one thing I see people doing in their younger years that can really affect their hormones and their health in the future. But besides that, you know, the basic things, smoking, cigarettes, tobacco, alcohol, eating a standard American diet, you know, not getting their nutrients in, not sleeping. That's a huge one. If you think you can, I mean, I don't know. I feel like some people can survive off of 6 hours a night, but I think it could catch up with us. And we know when we sleep, that's when we detox. That's when we detox our body. So even if we're going to bed, if we're eating a heavy meal right before bed, we're not going to let our body detox like it needs to. So not only being in bed enough hours, but not eating super heavy meal before going to bed.
Yeah, that's so interesting because as I'm thinking, about all of the questions my clients or that sort of demographic of people are like going to be throwing at me listening to this conversation. But when we have that, so we've got overtraining when we're younger, we've got sleep, which is going to be huge for any, especially for anyone that's a mum. Then we've got career, which is working super hard, super late, doing all that stuff. So all of these things are androgen depleting exercises or you know, activities to be engaged with on a persistent daily basis long term, especially for cycling women who probably should take their foot off the gas a couple of weeks or months, right? And so now I'm thinking 20 years passes, you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh shit, I did everything wrong. So is this like something that would be responsible for the weight loss resistance that people experience when they get to that sort of middle age where they're menopausal and doesn't matter what they do, that they're struggling to burn body fat or go shift anything about sort of their physical state because they've been in such a deficit for so many years?
Again, it can definitely contribute to that. But that weight loss resistance that women get around perimenopause, menopause, it's kind of multifactorial. You know, if their androgens have dropped off more quickly and just naturally because they've dropped off, that can affect our ability to lose weight, to build muscle mass. Remember, when we have more muscle or more insulin sensitive, And when we have more muscle, we burn more calories even at sitting. You know, our basal metabolic rate goes up. But also when like estrogen levels fluctuate or when estrogen declines, we have more issues with insulin resistance. Estrogen, I think of it as like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Estrogen has to be in that sweet spot to really help with our blood sugar. So if it's too high or if it's too low, we can start having issues with trying to lose weight. But even over time, like if we've got high cortisol, what cortisol does, one thing it does is it goes to the liver and it says, hey, liver, can you release more sugar into the blood? We got to get more sugar into the blood so we can run away from this tiger. And over time, that leads to insulin resistance, which can affect weight. So there's a few different things going on. And then, of course, we've got like the environmental exposures over time. And
there's a lot to consider.
Yeah, toxin buildup, and there's a lot that can affect weight.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the estrogen. Can we dig into that a little bit in regards to it being the Goldilocks and the Three Bears? Like, why is it so important, and where should it be, and where in sort of the general person is it that it should not be?
Yeah. So we just say, we don't want it too high, too low. Where it should be kind of depends on where someone is in their phase of life. Mm-hmm. But also, like for a cycling woman, you know, where she is in her cycle. Because we have some people who incorrectly collect their Dutch test. So we want women to collect their Dutch test in their mid luteal phase, which is about a week before they get their next period. Because then we can see the balance between estrogen and progesterone. But sometimes women collect right around ovulation. And so their estrogen comes back. You know, it looks really high on the Dutch test because our Dutch ranges are in reference to the luteal phase.
Yeah.
And during ovulation, it's normal. It's normal for estrogen to be twice as high or three times as high or four times as high as in the luteal phase. And so with estrogen, a lot of people kind of villainize it. They say estrogen is bad, but estrogen is actually really good and really necessary for men and women. You know, if you think about it for men, even if men have great testosterone, if their estrogen is low, it's going to impact their bone mineral density. Mm-hmm. And it can affect their libido, their ability to have erections, their lipid profile, their cholesterol, their mood. So it really does affect men too. But for women, you know, it's helping with our skin, hair, and nails. It's helping build that endometrium, which is like that lining of the uterus to support a pregnancy. It's helping to regulate our blood sugars. It affects our neurotransmitters and our mood. It's doing a lot. And so it's normal for estrogen to fluctuate throughout the cycle for a cycling woman. For a postmenopausal woman, that's when we start talking about hormone replacement therapy.
Okay.
Because for a postmenopausal woman, the ovaries stop making estrogen. There's no follicles developing. There's no follicles making estrogen. The only estrogen that women have in menopause is coming from the androgens, like the testosterone and DHEA that were made by the adrenals, but converted to estrogen in the fat tissue.
Mum, mother, grandmother, nan, nana, and women with no kids. Have I got your attention? So I want you to imagine something. Go with me here. Imagine a life where even when you wake up tired and the kids are driving you mad and work sucks and things are problematic, that you're still in control of your food and you still make healthy choices without giving up and binging on chocolate and wine and saying, I'll try again tomorrow. It might be hard to imagine, but having freedom with your food is absolutely possible. And it starts by getting three things right. One, having a supportive community, building a strong connection with fellow emotional eating warriors. Two, having the right information delivered in the right way. And three, having a guide that can shine a light on the right path and have your back along the way. And that's me. Those three things are exactly what we've got for you inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group for people just like you wanting to end their emotional eating and feel good in their own skin again. And currently, it's free to join. The link is in the show notes below. If you've struggled with diets or felt powerless around food, you're not alone. But let me assure you, this is a community that understands your battles and is ready to empower you into action. So what can you expect on the inside? Well, we have posts and content that push you a little out of your comfort zone. We do Facebook Lives, have interactive Q&A session, and it's simply a safe space to face your food challenges and be honest without concern of being judged. If you decide to join us, I have a complimentary How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook for you as well, completely free. The Healthy Mums Collective thrives on support, authenticity, and experience-based practices. It's a community, so the beautiful people in it is where the magic comes from. To join us and be a part of that magic, head to the show notes, click the link, breeze through a few quick questions, and you'll be in the Healthy Mums Collective before you know it. Again, the link is in the show notes below. I'll see you in the DMs or on the welcome post in just a few moments. And I'm assuming that's only assuming that the person isn't stressed and the priorities aren't adrenaline and cortisol in the first place. Like thinking about the hormone hierarchy that, you know, some of the sex hormones get no longer prioritized in the presence of a priority for the stress response.
Are you talking about like that? So the if you're talking about the pregnenolone steel or the progesterone steel.
Yeah.
They don't think that really exists. Because the research shows, it shows this, if stress goes up, if cortisol goes up, progesterone actually goes up.
Right.
Because the adrenals will make a little more progesterone. So you'll see baseline progesterone go up a little bit. But you're right. You're right in the fact that chronic stress, of course, can lower our hormones over time. And so chronic stress will eventually see lower testosterone, lower DHEA. So we have lower amounts of androgens to convert over to estrogen.
Right.
And so we'll just have, you know, even lower estrogen when we're menopausal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. You mentioned HRT too. So I got a question, which I ask everybody that brings up HRT, is it seems like even on the Western medical front, and on the natural front, that everybody is saying that you need HRT for the rest of your life. It's a wonder drug. And it just gives me the feelings of like all of the wonder drugs that have existed before, of which we didn't yet know the fallout or the consequence of. And everybody's like, it's amazing. It's the best thing ever. You've got to get it. I feel like I'm 25 again. And so I'm kind of a bit skeptical because it's like, why is nobody saying try and do it naturally? Is it just because it's so good and it's like, well, you can try it doing naturally, but you could feel this good as well? And it's like, well, in that case, why isn't everybody doing heroin? Because I'm sure that feels pretty good as well.
Right. I think it's because anything you do naturally won't elevate estrogen above the postmenopausal range.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, it can elevate it maybe a little bit. Like everything you do naturally, when it comes to estrogen levels, is going to be supporting the adrenals. And it'll only support androgen production from the adrenals. And so if you do a lot of adaptogens like maca or ashwagandha, for example, that can support adrenal health. It can support the entire HPA axis communication, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the communication. So it can improve androgen production and therefore improve estrogen, but it's only going to improve estrogen kind of within that postmenopausal range, which is still really, really low. And what the research is showing is you really do need to get estrogen above the postmenopausal range to see benefits with bone mineral density and cardiovascular disease or risk improvement. Hot flashes. For some women, natural things like black cohosh or vitamin E or Vitex, you know, they really do help with their hot flashes. I even had a provider tell me that a woman started doing ground flax seeds every day and just the lignans and the phytoestrogens in there like really helped her hot flashes. I was kind of amazed by that. But
yeah, right. So HRT will take you above the threshold that you mentioned before. Why won't natural stuff take you higher than that?
That's a good question. I think it's because the adrenals can only make so many androgens when we're older.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because the ACTH signal goes down. You know, some people know that the brain secretes ACTH and it tells the adrenals to make cortisol and it tells the adrenals to make androgens like DHEA and testosterone. So when we get older, our androgens don't decline because of the ACTH signal going down. The ACTH signal doesn't go down. I actually just saw a Dutch test of a 96-year-old woman, and she had a beautiful diurnal curve with her cortisol. Like, you know, cortisol is not supposed to go down as we age. Androgen production goes down because of changes with enzymes, enzymatic function within the adrenals. And so just naturally, our androgens go down over time. And so naturally, if you think about it, when we're menopausal, our ovaries, we're no longer cycling, we're no longer making follicles. So our ovaries are no longer making estrogen. And when we're younger, that's the main contributor to our estrogen levels, are the ovaries. The ovaries make a lot of estrogen. But when you take away the ovaries and you're only getting estrogen from those androgens that were made by the adrenals, which are naturally lower, there's no way you're going to make estrogen like you did when you were younger and cycling.
Yeah. Is there an argument in the space, I was going to say natural space, but maybe on either side, that we should just be following what nature intended?
Yeah, there's definitely that argument. And for some women, it's necessary. There's contraindications to hormones, so it's not safe for everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, women who have a lot of cardiovascular disease, who have coronary heart disease, history of stroke, blood clots, DVTs, pulmonary embolisms, liver disease, what else? History of a estrogen receptor positive neoplasm. Doesn't have to be in the breast, could be anywhere. If it's estrogen receptor positive, they say that's a contraindication to estrogen therapy. So it's not safe for everyone, but for the majority of women, it is safe. And it is something to consider because we do have a lot of research on it showing the benefits for heart health, for brain health. Well, the research on cognition is a little mixed. But heart health, for hot flashes, for vaginal dryness, for bone mineral density, there's some good research on that. And that's probably why, you know, NAMS, North American Menopause Society, there we go.
Nailed it.
They say there's like approved indications for estrogen therapy. One of them is the prevention of osteoporosis. Another is moderate to severe hot flashes. And then we've got, you know, genitourinary syndrome issues like pain with sex and vaginal dryness.
Yeah.
So there's some good research to back it up. And when women hit menopause, their risk for heart attack goes way up. It's equal to that of men because they no longer have that protective effects of estrogen.
Yeah, interesting. I'm assuming as well, because it seems like there's this sort of conundrum with, you know, you don't want to overtrain when you're younger and burn out your androgens. And then later you're sort of lacking some of these hormones, but increased muscle mass is of benefit to the hormone management, you know, the endocrine system. Yeah. And also if you're lifting heavy things, surely that improves your osteoporosis outcomes because you're increasing calcium demand in the bones. So it seems like where's the sweet spot of how much to exercise and work out?
Right. You know, if I could choose one, which I think would be more effective, you know, diet and lifestyle over a lifetime or HRT, I think the diet and lifestyle is the way to go. But a lot of us aren't taking really good care of ourselves like we should.
That's why we both have jobs.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I'm in the health field and right now with these two little ones, I'm like sleep deprived.
Of course.
Sometimes I don't eat my veggies. And so I think HRT can, you know, estrogen therapy can really help a lot of women just kind of feel good for longer in their lives.
And who doesn't want that?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, for breast cancer risk, one of the things that can increase risk for breast cancer is like high estrogen exposure over one's lifetime. And so it's not like we want to take a lot of estrogen. We don't want to hit menopause and take lots of estrogen because it's going to just increase that overall exposure to estrogen throughout our life. So we want to take it within moderation, and we're always trying to use the lowest effective dose.
Yeah, right. And that's just to get back to sort of a baseline that feels sort of normal for the individual? And is the baseline of that feeling sort of a feeling, or is it a metric? And is that metric different for everyone?
It can be both. Sometimes it's resolution of the hot flashes, or maybe they're only getting two or three hot flashes and they can handle it. You know, they're not getting 20 a day anymore. But it also could be measured by like a DEXA scan. You know, you could look at bone mineral density and see if it's improving or if it's just not getting worse over time. So it's definitely through, you know, metrics and how people are feeling. It kind of depends on the person, what they're struggling with, and their own medical history.
Yeah, right. And that estrogen metabolism, because I know from sort of having some conversations with some sort of HRT bioidentical advocates in the past that apparently there was a study done some time ago in regards to breast cancer risk and HRT, and that it was incredibly misleading. Am I correct in saying that? Because, and now it's frightened a lot of people away from HRT use.
Yeah. In the early 2000s, a lot of women, I think over 50% of women, got off their HRT because of the outcomes of the Women's Health Initiative in 2002. So the Women's Health Initiative stopped their study because they noticed that there was an increased risk for breast cancer. But when they went through and they reevaluated all of the data, they realized it was non-significant. It was like less than 1 in 1,000 women, you know, increased risk for breast cancer. So it was very rare. It was very rare. And they realized that with the Women's Health Initiative, there were some flaws. Some of the women didn't even have the hot flashes or these complaints of menopause. A lot of them were older, like in their 60s. They had already been through menopause years and years prior, a decade prior. And we know once you're over 60, 65, once you're more than 10 years out from menopause, if you start hormones, your risks outweigh your benefits. So you really do want to start hormones within like the first 5 years, first three years, I would say, of entering menopause. That's where you're going to see the most benefit.
That's so interesting. I've not come across somebody that said that. So the risks outweigh the benefits after 10 years. Why is that?
You asked some really good questions. I think it's just due to age over time. You know, when women are low in estrogen, when they're postmenopausal, things tend to decline. You know, their risk for cardiovascular events goes up. Usually brain health declines. Yeah, cardiovascular health declines. And I think that maybe those systems just aren't as strong or as healthy as they were before to support that estrogen. Because there are some studies that, you know, once you get 8-10 years out from menopause, you might actually want to lower, like if you're going to continue hormones, you might actually want to lower the amount of estrogen you're taking, because they found that the doses that women were taking in their early 50s might increase their risk of cardiovascular events like later on in life as they're getting older. But of course, they were looking at oral estrogens. And really, as women get older, they should not be on oral estrogen, because oral estrogen increases risk for stroke and for clots, whereas transdermal is going to be the safer option.
Yeah, right. So the molecular pathways and mechanisms and homeostatic, I guess, strengths of the body, if you will, have decreased to a point that reigniting them or trying to turn them back on is going to cause more damage. It makes me kind of think of something that's rusted together, and then we're trying to like fire it back up again, like an engine that's got parts that have rusted, and we try and fire it back up and like it breaks in 10 places.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I think of it too. I don't know if that's correct, but that's how I think of it also. I think there are certain things that may still see improvements. Like I want to say maybe bone mineral density, but
get in the gym.
But I'm forgetting there. Yeah. Lift weights. Lift weights starting in your 20s. Keep it up.
Yeah. Well, I was also going to ask, in some of the studies that you've looked at, with is that all calculated out of the equation? The standard American diet, the lack of exercise for 45 years, you know, the sleep deprivation, the career which kept the person cortisol triggered 24/7, you know, is that sort of factored out of the equation to say, yeah, HRT is not beneficial 10 years out?
To say that HRT is not beneficial 10 years out, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, maybe we should do a study.
I know. Yeah, right. I think a lot of these studies, they'll try to take into account like if people are smoking or if people are on certain medications, or they'll try to take that into account when they're looking at the statistics and looking through the data. But yeah, I don't know. It's a good question.
It is. We should send it to somebody who can do a study on it.
Yeah.
I'm curious as well, before we sort of, I guess, finish our conversation, what are the things that you really want people listening to know about either using the Dutch test or why they might use it, but also moving into that space of perimenopause, menopause, and therefore HRT and bioidenticals? What do you really want people to know so that they feel comfortable, safe, or know where to go next?
I would say one thing with the Dutch test is we can look at how women are metabolizing their estrogen, you know, their own estrogen that they're making, but also estrogen that they're taking. And for example, I'm going to try to like make this really basic. Sometimes women will metabolize their estrogen down pathways that increase risk for breast cancer. And so another way to say it is sometimes women metabolize their estrogen into this, we call it an estrogen catechol, 4OH, like the 4OH estrogens. And the 4OH metabolates can become reactive. We call them reactive quinones. So they become unstable and reactive, and they can attach to DNA and damage it. And so they can increase risk for breast cancer. And the risk for breast cancer overall in the population is rare. But if I'm a woman with a history of high estrogen and fibroids, and if I'm overweight, and if I'm smoking and have diabetes, and maybe I have all these risk factors for breast cancer, and my mom had it when she was 50, you know, if I decide to take hormones, like I might want to look at the Dutch test to see how I'm going to metabolize that estrogen, just so I don't increase my risk further, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think for every woman, even younger women who are not on hormones, can see if they're pushing their estrogen, their own estrogen down that pathway, because it can affect risk over time. You know, I check my Dutch almost every year just to check that pathway to see if I'm pushing down that pathway, because I've got a family history of breast cancer. You know, a lot of us do. But besides that, you know, there's another pathway. There's another metabolite. It's called 16-OHE1. And that pathway is more associated with breast cancer risk, but also autoimmune issues, inflammation, tumor growth, tissue proliferation. And so I think also knowing as a woman, if you take hormones and if you're pushing it into that 16 pathway, you might have more tissue proliferation in the breast tissue or in the uterus. You know, if you take estrogen, you might have an increased chance of having breast tenderness with it or breakthrough bleeding with it. So the Dutch test can give you a little idea of, you know, possibly might you have some side effects with the HRT, or if you are having breast tenderness with HRT, maybe it's because you're metabolizing it into this more proliferative 16 pathway. So I think that's an important thing. One other thing, kind of random, but I tell everyone this. If you're in your 20s, your 30s, even 40s, like get a baseline hormone test. Even if it's in the serum, you know, men, test your testosterone in your 20s so that when you're 50 or 60 and starting to struggle with libido issues or erection issues, you can see like what your normal was when you were feeling good and healthy in your 20s or your 30s. Because, you know, every man's normal is going to be different, and you can see how much it's changed over time. Or even women, you know, just kind of checking in on hormones when you're younger, on your androgen levels, you can kind of see where they are when you're feeling your best.
Yeah, that's good advice. I had mine I checked just last year, actually.
Yeah.
In regards to, well, testosterone and a few other little things. But yeah, it's useful to find out, and you learn a lot about yourself when you discover that. And you're like, oh, my life makes sense all of a sudden.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've got low androgens. I've got low estrogen. I was just so happy I got pregnant again. So
yeah. What a gift. Hey.
Yeah. Oh, such a gift. But you can really feel it when you have low androgens. You can definitely feel it.
Yeah. Just a personal share on discovering mine is that I cycled for quite literally years between, you know, and this is maybe the rabbit hole or the burden of the person with too much knowledge, which is that I was cycling between blaming my psychology and being like, oh, it's some kind of trauma or dark, bad thing that I feel, you know, because I was sort of experiencing a lot of depression, as many people were, lockdowns and, you know, COVID and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it felt really uncharacteristic, not just circumstantial, if that makes any sense. And so I went so long bouncing between, oh, it must be my diet. Oh, maybe I'm not working out enough. Oh, maybe I haven't done enough therapy, or there's something that I can't uncover. And then going and trying all of these weird and wonderful ways to hack my psychology and go deep into my soul, only to discover my testosterone was catastrophically low, although I had no real physical signs of that or evidence of that. And then I got on a handful of herbs, you know, the sort of Vidoja agrestis, Sistanch, Shilajit, the sort of, you know, Chinese medicine, or even naturopathic sort of stack, if you like. And mental health has been rock solid ever since.
Wow.
It was just boosting up that testosterone.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And even with the herbs.
It's so useful to find out.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it can be super, super helpful. I was just thinking about my my own mood issues too. I mean, we all have it. I definitely had more anxiety and depression before I had children. And then once I got pregnant and I got all that progesterone, my daily anxiety went away, and I haven't had it since. I mean, I'll get a little bit here and there, but it's not like it used to be. So pregnancy can really change people for the good or for the, you know, for the better or for the worse.
Yeah, totally. I've definitely heard of cases of people with sort of endometriosis or even adenomyosis and having a baby cleared it up, like gone. Kind of, and you know, and maybe that's the one in a million, I don't know, but it's amazing how, we sort of put our body through a circumstance or situation that is the definition of nature, procreation, and everything can fall back into alignment.
Yeah. Yeah. Or out of alignment.
Yeah. For some people, obviously it doesn't go so good.
Yeah.
But where can everybody find you on the internet, interwebs? Where can they get the Dutch test? Where are you sending people?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can go to dutchtest.com to learn more about the Dutch test. We also have a lot of blogs. We've got a Dutch podcast. We've got webinars that we do every month. You know, there's a lot of education on there. You want to learn more about hormones or even about Dutch testing. And then I have an Instagram. It's just Dr. Kelly Roof, like DrKellyRuef, as in Frank or family. But I haven't been posting as much lately. I've got a lot to do with the little ones, but I'm hoping to get back on that.
Yeah, I'll put all of those links down in the show notes below, just so everybody can scroll down, click the link, and jump into your world. So I encourage everybody listening to do that. Obviously, Kelly is a brilliant mind, and everybody should be caring about their hormones in this dreadfully toxic, dopamine addicted, stress infused world that we all live within, right?
Oh yes, dopamine addicted, for sure, myself included.
And before we wrap up, like, what is one piece of health information of all the stuff you know that you wish more people knew about?
I would say a big one is cortisol, like testing cortisol to see where your cortisol is at, because cortisol, like if you have high cortisol long term, can have a lot of detrimental effects on your health. It can affect, you know, if you have IBS, it can affect your cardiovascular health, your ability to be sensitive to insulin, to regulate your blood sugars. It can affect mood, anxiety, depression. And so I think it's important. I just think it can be helpful for people to test their cortisol, their diurnal pattern throughout the day, and just see where they're at. Because, I mean, I tested my own, and I've got, every time I test, my cortisol is above range. So I obviously know, like, I'm putting myself at risk for these right. issues over time. And I think it's important that people know that, you know, start early. It's not too late to start, you know, taking control of your health, whether you're 20 or 75, it's not too late to start. There's always something we can do to improve our health and to feel better. So I would say, yeah, look at cortisol and it's never too late to start.
Beautiful message. Thank you. And I appreciate your time and energy being here on the podcast, and hopefully we can have you back soon.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
No worries. Thanks, Kel. See you later.
Nice to see you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast. Simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.